Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author Kathleen Rooney discusses her new book, From Dust to Stardust, with writer and lecturer Ignatius Aloysius. The following conversation originally took place September 6th, 2023, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Hey, good evening, everybody. How are we doing tonight? All right. So welcome. I'm Kerry Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum, and I want to thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. We're here tonight to celebrate the publication of a novel about Hollywood, history, and true second acts. From Dust to Stardust is a Depression-era Cinderella story reviewers called bewitching, enrapturing, full of magic and moxie. Author Kathleen Rooney is a founding editor of Rose Metal Press, a nonprofit publisher of literary work in hybrid genres, as well as a founding member of Poems While You Wait, a collective of poets and their vintage typewriters who compose poetry on demand. Her most recent books include the novels Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk and Cher Ami and Major Whittlesey. Her poetry collection, Where Are the Snows, won the 2021 XJ Kennedy Prize and was published by the Texas Review Press in fall of 2022. She's a winner of the Ruth Lilly Prize from Poetry Magazine and the Adam Morgan Literary Citizen Award from the Chicago Review of Books. Her criticism appears in the New York Times, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the Brooklyn Rail, Chicago Magazine, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. She's joined in conversation by two-time Pushcart Prize nominee and novelist Ignatius Valentine Aloysius. So please join me in welcoming them both.
Thank you. So I think Kathleen's going to read before we begin the Q&A.
Great. Okay. So yes. Yeah, so thank you so much, Ignatius, for being here. I'm excited to get to the questions, but first, just a little bit about the book. It's based on the life and work of Colleen Moore, the silent movie star who built the fairy castle at the Museum of Science and Industry. Who has seen it? Yeah. Who hasn't seen it? Okay, that's all good because you're in for a treat. If you know, and you can go find out. So the book itself is structured so that Colleen has been invited to the museum to record an audio guide for the castle, which she has donated. And so she's going room by room through the castle, and then that sort of sets her back on her memories of how she got to Hollywood and became famous and her second act and things like that. And in my book, it's Doreen O'Dare fictionalized, because, you know, it is a biographical novel, but I did make stuff up. But if you get the book, which you will be able to by the end of the night, it's got like the library, the small hall, the drawing room, like all the different rooms and objects. And then, yeah, I'm just going to read a very Chicago-y scene, because I think one of the things I'm interested in is people who know what they want to do. I always am fascinated by people who rise to the top of their field, because often when you ask them, they've like known since birth that it's something they wanted to do. And so Doreen and Colleen seem like they were this kind of people. So this is sort of that discovery. And it's very Chicago because Walter Howie, the great newspaper editor, was her uncle. And so I thought I would give you some of him too. So just a couple pages. Aunt Lib liked to call me the child of my soul. Uncle Walter called me the child of my imagination. A hard-bitten newspaper man, he had a glass eye, and he'd never tell anyone how he got it. I'm not sure that even Aunt Lib knew the truth. Legend attributed the orb to the circulation wars of his early days in the Windy City, a time when gangs employed by rival papers waged battles in the streets, or less romantically, to Walter's passing out drunk and impaling himself on a copy spike. The quip among his underlings was that you could identify the glass eye because it was the warmer one. Mum, as he always remained on that topic, he loved to regale me with his tales of his biggest scoops. The one that launched his career came in the final days of 1903, when he was strolling through the snowy Chicago Loop and happened upon a knight and three clowns climbing from a manhole. They were actors fleeing the Iroquois Theater, which had gone up in flames during a matinee performance of the musical Mr. Bluebeard based on the fairy tale. The inferno killed 600 people, most of them children and their mothers, the deadliest theater blaze in United States history. Uncle Walter filed his copy as people were still escaping into the sewers via the theater cellar, breaking the story nationwide in the next day's early editions, establishing his reputation for aggressiveness and steady nerve. I loved Uncle Walter more than I did my own father. I admitted this to no one but the fairies as I set out small treasures for them on the guest room windowsill. From Granny's stories, I knew the good people to be fond of child swapping, and I begged them to make me Uncle Walter and Aunt Lib's changeling. Wings veined with silver, luminous as the moonlight, the fairy princess appeared to me in the night and explained, "It doesn't work that way, but we're interested in you, so we'll see what we can do." Her companions formed a circle bright as a chandelier and echoed her words in unison before vanishing. Feeling as if I'd slept a dozen years, I woke the next morning to find the windowsill bare. I'll never know what role exactly the fairies played, but while Lib and Walter never adopted me, each did take an early hand in steering the remarkable course of my life by means I can't imagine that either ever intended. In a funny way, the tragedy at the Iroquois Theater played a part too. Though Walter always told the story of his first scoop in a tone that framed it as an adventure, it had in fact shaken him, just a callow lad then, fresh from Des Moines, deeply. For the rest of his life, he could no longer sit comfortably in a theater without his eyes being drawn toward likely hiding spots for pyrotechnics, potential obstacles to exit routes. His aversion didn't rub off on Lib, who'd taken a show any time the chance arose, when entertaining a visiting niece, for instance. So you see, I was never pushed to be an actress. I was pulled from the instant I saw my first play. One muzzy summer afternoon when I was 5, Aunt Lib and I rode the L from their apartment in Uptown to the Loop, where Maud Adams' production of Peter Pan was playing at the Illinois Theater. Aunt Lib was as eager to see the illustrious actress as I was to see the tale of the boy who refused to grow up. I sat on the edge of a red velvet seat as plush as a muffled heartbeat and grabbed Aunt Lib's hand at the curtain going up, the theater tense and waiting. As much as Wendy and Tiger Lily and all the Lost Boys, what made an impression was my comprehension of the spell cast and captivating an audience. Equally enwrapt by watching the performance and the other children's reactions, I realized that people's emotions are delicious to me. Tears streamed down my face as Tinkerbell lay dying, but I didn't notice until Aunt Lib dabbed my cheeks with a handkerchief. She whispered through the dark, "Are you all right, Eileen?" Peter came to the footlights and spoke to us directly. "All the children who believe in fairies, please clap your hands. If you truly believe, then you can save Tinkerbell." I scrambled to stand on my chair, damp-faced and screaming, clapping like a trained seal. "I believe in fairies," I piped, my tiny voice amplified by some magic of architecture. "I really do." Every eye turned from the stage to me. Maud Adams herself laughed in her feathered cap and floppy collar, and the audience followed suit. Many people, I know, find notoriety mortifying. In that instant, I learned that I am not one of those. "Thank you, little miss," Maud said, becoming Peter again. "All you lot, join her and clap. Help us save Tink." And by a river of applause, the show flowed on. Aunt Lib's gentle hands pulled me into her lilac-scented lap, but those fingers may as well have been the steady force of my dream taking permanent hold. An actress? No, I thought even then. I did not intend to become only an actress. I meant to become a star.
Thank you, Kathleen. That was just great.
Thank you.
It just brought back everything from reading the novel. I want to start by thanking all of you for being here and thanking the American Writers Museum for having us. I really enjoyed this novel and really appreciated the chance to read an early copy of it. It was quite a privilege and a joy to get into something like this and to know that it was coming out in the world. Your title, From Dust to Stardust, and in case you want to know what the cover looks like, gorgeous cover. It points to far-reaching consequences in the lives of its characters, especially that of your first person, Doreen O'Dair, inspired by silent film actress Colleen Moore, whose original name, her birth name, was Eileen Sullivan. I don't know if any of you knew that. I didn't. Before we delve deeper into both their fictional and real lives, can you talk about your interest And taking this direction as a writer, your inspiration for giving us this story now in these times, and if you share any parallels to Hollywood or to the narrative itself.
Yeah, there's so much there. So I'll answer several things. So first, I think one of the reasons that I wanted to tell the story at all is ever since I was a kid and when I first laid eyes on the castle, I was intrigued by the person who made it. And it's a thing, Eric Plattner from Poems While You Wait is in the front row. He helped come up with the title. And also he and I talk often about how Mr. Rogers, do you guys like Mr. Rogers? Whenever he would teach you about things, you know, he wouldn't say like, we're gonna go to the glasses factory. He would say, we're gonna go meet the people who made the glasses. And so I think that emphasis on the people who create things is beautiful. And so thanks to the Museum of Science and Industry's information, the first time I saw it, I was like, who built this? And they were like, Colleen Moore. That just like intrigued me because that was a stage name. Her real name was Kathleen Morrison, and she, right? And she changed it for her pursuit of fame, but also then used that fame to help people. And so I think that kind of ties to your mention of the title. Like there's this sort of idea of going from not nothing, but from something smaller to something bigger, something humble to something like stratospheric. And so I kind of like that. And then I started writing the book, kind of like not even writing, but thinking I was going to write it toward the end of 2016. And I was feeling pretty dispirited for all kinds of reasons. And it was just making me think back to other times when there was sort of like a national darkness and a time when people were not trusting each other, feeling very down about themselves and the future. And so I just thought it was beautiful that Colleen had taken her castle, this beautiful object, and used it not just for her pleasure, but to remind people that beauty isn't useless, or that contemplating something magical can bring people together. I love historical fiction. And one of my things that I like to do is take people who I think should be more known now and try to like point people back to them. So even though my protagonist is Doreen O'Dare, I really hope like after tonight that, you know, if you haven't seen the castle, you'll go see it. If you have seen it, you'll see it again. If you haven't watched one of her movies, you'll like watch one of her movies. So I think I covered everything.
You did. I like the idea of you mentioning dust and the title, because really their lives, her family's lives were quite shaky in that sense as she was growing up. And it sort of reminded me of how difficult it was, and for being a female in that time and for being 14 years old and having these high ambitions, she never gave up. And I like the idea of how she goes from dust to stardust. And I think that was definitely a karmic journey for her. Does anybody know SNA Studios in Chicago? I did not know this, but I lived in Uptown for many years and I had no idea that SNA Studios existed. And that's where Charlie Chaplin's The Tramp was filmed, which was quite startling to me. I was like, oh, this is amazing. But also, I like the idea of how her trips back to Chicago and to see Uncle Walter and Aunt Lib were the anchor positions in her life. And she, for some reason, she kept going back to Chicago because that was the stepping stone for her to move into stardom. Because then she ended up taking that first screen test at SNA, and that's how it moves. So do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I love that a few of you were like, yes. You can go see, it's not still the studio. It's St. Augustine College now, so it's still the building being used for other purposes, but it's got like Chicago landmark status, and it has the icons, and it says SNA. And if you're like, why is it called SNA? Spohr and Anderson were the two impresarios who founded it, so SNA, get it, and then mm-hmm. It became ESSANAY. And so I just think like that's another thing I love about history and historical fiction, to sort of remind people that like before Hollywood was in Hollywood, it was in Chicago. And I think a big factor, you can guess why they moved, it was like mostly the weather. You can't shoot year round, so easily, unless you are like making a lot of like Arctic stories or whatever, in Chicago. So they quickly realized that, California was a little more hospitable to that. But I do think it's cool to think of that stuff happening. And another thing that I found in my research that I try to capture in that scene and then in other scenes of once Doreen is off to Hollywood, I think a lot of times the cliche of like when you're filming or doing a test or something for cinema is like quiet on the set, you know, like the little snap and like everybody shh. But during silent movies, you didn't have to do that because they were silent, like you weren't recording synchronized sound. And so one of the things I learned from the reminiscences of different people, from directors to actors, is how noisy the sets could be, both the just people watching or like the electricians up in the rafters, like watching and laughing if a bit was funny, or Lillian Gish, one of my favorite actresses, supposedly, like, you know, when she did this death scene in La Boheme, like every single person on the crew was just like weeping, like audibly, just like ugly crying. So I think that's interesting. And then also actors would hire, or studios would hire like, mood musicians too. So if you needed to get pepped up for a big scene, there would be like a jazz orchestra, playing not for the soundtrack, but just for the ambiance of what the actors were doing. Or there was, like when Colleen, the real inspiration, was in the movie So Big and was playing an older woman, she spoke about how she forewent the jazz and got like a sadder violinist to help her get into the mindset of this older, more tragic character. So I don't know. I just like walking by SNA and thinking like, you know, not just Chaplin, but everybody who was there kind of enjoying the show.
I mean, it was a big theater, a big studio at that time.
It was.
There's a moment in the early part of the novel where Uncle Walter gives her as a gift a locket, and maybe you can talk about that. I don't want to give too much away, but the locket was a pivotal moment in her life and in the choices she made in her life.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think about a lot is I'm a teacher at DePaul, so shout out DePaul. There's lots of DePaul in the house. Go Blue Demons. Just how much, like, life hopefully for people is long, but how much formative stuff happens to you when you're very tiny, and how, like, at the time, sometimes you can feel that something is formative, and other times it just comes to you and you have to wait and then realize how important it was. So this is... This tiny dictionary, and you know, the gift is given with this idea of like, this is all the words, you know, you're gonna need to know for your future. Like, you might not know them all now, but you're gonna, you know, it's like this forward thinking gift. And I think, I don't know, I think part of me, I mean, that's just something that is a detail, but for me, that's kind of what the castle was too. Like, my 8-year-old self didn't know that I was seeing something that someday my like 40 something self was gonna like write a book about and be in a room with all you like talking about. It's bonkers. And then like my sister Beth is here, and I don't have kids, but I have a niece and nephew who I love so much. And I love to think about what Rose and Luca are seeing now. They're 9 and 12, and like what they're seeing now, what they've already seen, what they're like soon about to see, like on a field trip or on a vacation or just in their backyard, that's going to like make them whatever it is they're going to be. So I thought it was fun to kind of put something like that in, to be like, you know, why did she end up like this? Like, lots of things.
She really inspired me a lot. I felt that the way you handled, not just from a craft position, but from a standpoint of getting into the character as an author and understanding and bridging timelines, which is very difficult to do because we're talking about the Flapper age and then bringing it all back to the reader in 1968, where the novel is situated. I felt that was very difficult to do as a novelist, but you pulled it off so well, and I really admired you know, her as a character, but also her bravado in being a female, challenging all the social norms, all the male-dominated parts of industry where she was entering, never knowing how her life was going to change, and just trusting divine intervention. So I want to talk about a little bit about voices and signs and how she trusted that so much, and how she trusted it enough to keep her from harm, because she faced a lot of challenges along the way. And I call it the Council of the Fairies, so to speak. It's central, which is a central idea that runs through the entire novel, not just in her early years, but it becomes such a pivotal part of her life in the decisions she makes and receiving and being aware and of the signs that she was receiving from time to time. And I think we can all relate to this in our lives. There's a moment in our lives where you just realize something is happening, and then you go, oh, I have to listen to this. And maybe you call it your gut, your instinct, but it's something, it's the divine intervention. Can you elaborate further on this as you talk about her searching, her reliance on her grandmother and her distinct ambition?
Yeah, I think one of the things that interests me too about like great artists or people who become super renowned in their field is that often we from the outside just see them and we're like, that's the star, that's the genius, that's the, you know, lead singer or whatever. And it's not to take anything away from that. That is an achievement and that is that person. But usually those people have a bunch of people who are around them and who help them and, you know, without whom they couldn't have done what they did. And so I loved getting to create that relationship on the page with the grandmother, who isn't just like a chaperone, but really is like a wise counsel and offers all this insight into, you know, things way beyond just like staying safe from, you know, creepy men in Hollywood. And then I think like as I was thinking, I don't know, like there's lots of writers in the audience and you're a writer. And I think one of the things that's cool about writing is it itself can become a way to pay attention to those signs. Like, you know, you want to write about something and then you're like, why? And you have like your surface answer of why. And then as you're going into it, you're like, but why else? And so I think for me to speak to that, you know, if you want to call it gut instinct, like the mystical, the metaphysical, I think I was interested in the way that that works for individuals, but also this like Celtic idea of thin places, which is sort of that folkloric idea of how there's like a membrane between the visible world that we're all in right now, and then the other world, the invisible world, whatever that consists of, and whatever it contains, and how in so many of the Celtic stories, the fairies are like fickle and have opinions and they can help you, but they can just as easily trick you. And there's all these stories of like the fairy gold. You're like, I've got all of it. And then you like touch it and it just turns to leaves and you're like, they tricked me. You know, so I think that's interesting. And so I think, so the individual, the Celtic folklore, and then even cinema, I think early cinema, especially silent movies, seem themselves like a thin place where, because I think now we like see movies all the time, we have a million streaming services, and it's not that mind blowing to be like, oh yeah, there's these people on a screen. But back then it really was like coming through almost from another world. And even the screen is sort of like a membrane. And I think a good book can be like that, where you're like, and thank you for the compliment on the time toggling, where you're like reading a book and you know it's 2023, but you're like, oh, I thought it was 1968. I thought it was 1923. And so I think that's kind of a thin place too. So, but I don't think I knew that when I like started writing it. It just came to me more as I was like, why do I want to do this? So
yeah, that was going to be my next question, yeah. Whether that was a strategic move on your part, if you decided that placing the reader in 1920 versus in 1968, because they were both very important times in American history, at least in the past centuries, in this century. So I want to just add something. You mentioned the metaphysical aspect of our lives and how we sometimes wish good things on people. We say a prayer for someone. We wish that someone gets better or they find success in their lives. And it reminded me a lot of Jose Silva's, I don't know if anyone has read this book, it's called The Mind Control Method, and where he talks about you can imagine someone getting better if they are sick, and you keep imagining that. And I felt that there is something that happens as a recurrent theme in the novel where she never lets go of this idea of the divine intervention, and I'm just using divine intervention as in a loose way. You could call it God, you could call it the universe or voices, but she never lets go of that. And because of that one road she takes of trusting this part in her life, she knows where she needs to go in spite of all the challenges that she faces.
Yeah, I think one of the things that struck me about the real inspiration, Colleen Moore, that I definitely wanted to put into Dorian, was that she was a faithful person. She was Catholic and she was a believer. And like, if you go see the fairy castle, one of my favorite artifacts as a kid, there's so many, and maybe after when we talk, people can tell me your favorite artifact in the castle. But in the chapel, this beautiful, beautiful chapel of the castle, there's a piece of the one true cross that like Jesus died on. And it's, and like in the narration, you hear that she was friends, you know, she had lots of friends who also moved in these circles, like Claire Booth Luce, who was the ambassador to Italy, and who was, she lost her daughter in a tragic car accident, and she became a Catholic convert. And so when she got this ambassadorship, I don't know exactly all the details, but she got an audience with the Pope, and the Pope gave this to her as a token. And she was like, this means a lot to me, but who it's really going to mean a lot to is my friend, Colleen/Doreen. And Doreen like put it in the castle. And I think in a way that's kind of like, what, the castle? And then you're like, but there's no better place for it. It's just, she's like, this is a beautiful thing and I should put it where other people can see it. And I think whether you think that relics are real or whether you think that religion is real or any of that stuff, I think to me as a fiction writer and as someone who is fascinated by people and all the ways they can think and behave, I love stuff like that. So I think I just wanted to put that in and engage with that in a like sincere way.
I want you to talk about her grandmother, because I felt that I liked her grandmother so much, aside from Colleen's role in the novel. She was always with her until the moment that, I'm not going to give that away, but can you talk about her grandmother a little bit? And as a second part question, some of the other people in her life that helped her.
Yeah, again, I think one of the things I was struck by is just the fact that the grandmother going with her made so many other things possible. You know, it happened in real life, and then I develop it in the book. And just this idea of, like, even when everything is so hard, and I think, again, there's so many writers, and I think probably other artists in the room tonight, like, it's so much rejection, and so much of, like, succeeding in the field is just, like, refusing to give up and just kind of, like, making a pest of yourself until finally the door opens. And I think that becomes much more possible when you've got at least one person in your corner unconditionally. And I think I really saw that in the grandmother dynamic, just someone who was like, yeah, it's going to be hard and I'm going to acknowledge the hardness, but I'm going to tell you, you can do it. And I'm not going to let you give up. And I hope everyone in the room has at least one person who helps with that. But I also was struck, you know, in doing the research by how, you know, the thing about the silent era is they would make, not everyone, but so many films. They were just like, the phrase cranking them out, right, comes from that. They were cranking them out because it was so lucrative. It was mass culture. You just wanted to keep having new stuff to send out to the theaters and get the audiences to come in. You know, so it's not to say that, you know, an actress would get along with or have like a great auteur style bond with every director. But I was struck by Mickey Nealon was one of the directors that she liked to work with, so I put that in there. They seem to have like a sympathetic style of working. Mervyn LeRoy, who went on to direct movies too, but he got his start as a comedy constructor. And this is a real detail that I put in, because he, like, normally they would call them gag men. And he didn't like that. He said it sounded like he was like choking people or something. He's like, my mother doesn't like that. So he's like comedy constructor, which sounds so like pretentious, but charming. Like, he was like, no, I'm doing this thing. And, you know, they had a bond too. So I think just kind of like, it can happen at places like the American Writers Museum, finding your people, finding not just your relatives who like, hopefully love you unconditionally, but finding other people who are like, I see what you're doing. I like what you're doing. Let's maybe do some stuff together. You know, don't give up, even if everybody doesn't like it. It's still worth doing. And this is the point at which I should also say, I'm trying to give lots of shout outs. If I don't shout you out, I'm sorry, but Poems While You Wait, I feel like there's so many Poems While You Wait people here. And I think you guys are that for me. So thank you.
Thank you. I want to take us to 1968, because I feel that when the novel opens in 1968, the first couple of pages, there's a preface that sort of summarizes everything in her life. And then we begin reading the interview that she has with Gladys, who is a reporter that wants to know more about Colleen in 1968, because now we're looking back in time. I really love the idea of you taking both the timelines and bringing them together. As I said before, it's very difficult to do because you want the reader to stay with you and not be lost in the telling versus the showing. But I felt that you pulled it off so well. Can you talk about Gladys's role, and was that sort of a craft technique that you brought in, or yeah, how did that happen?
Yeah. So people who have been to the castle over the years, as I have, like when I first went, when I was 8, they still had, and maybe some people remember, little telephones, the little telephone receivers. People are nodding. I remembered it, and it was true, but it was one of those things where as I was like going to write it, I was like, was that real, or do I just want it to be real? Was it a dream I had? But it was real, and it was great. And you'd pick it up, and it would be her voice telling you things and giving you these details. Like, you know, you'd be looking at the library and thinking how beautiful it was, and then she'd be like, oh, this chair is shaped like this because there's a little fairy prince who likes to read with his feet up in the air. And you were just like, oh my God, like, it's so compelling. You were just like seeing it. So I knew when I sat down to write it that I wanted to like bring in that like a retrospective and like super personal narration of this object. And so I was like, who would she be talking to? So I came up with Gladys. And then I think Gladys is almost like a stand-in for the audience. You know, it's like the keyhole that you look through to see the rest of the building that is the story. And something that, you know, again, lots of students here, I always like to talk about the occasion of the telling, which is like this idea of the frame, like you're saying, of like, how are you going to get the audience what they need to know in the most efficient way that they're not going to be confused? And so it's like the occasion of the telling is like, why tell this story? Why tell it in this way? And why tell it now? And now is not like now in 2023, because that's when your book's coming out, but like the now of the story, like why is your character, why are your people sitting here looking back and like going on about whatever they're going on about? And so, I thought 1968 would be a good year, just, you know, because something I was interested in is the way that the castle was not just a private celebrity indulgence, but then put to this use of being taken on the road during the Great Depression and touring to cities and being set up at department stores and becoming this ballyhoo event where people would come see it together. And she got criticism at the time, I mean, in the press, and there were, you know, remarks of like, why is she, like, you know, kind of like you would hear now, like, why build a castle and tour it? Why not just put money on the problem? Like, why not just cut out the middleman? And I think her point, you know, and in interviews and things when she talked about it, was like to sort of do something magical and kind of, you know, have a chance for herself to go among the people and for the people to go among each other and realize, like, we're all in this together, as bad as it is. And then, so I thought 1968, I mean, that's another year where so much stuff was happening, right? Like, it's just a chaotic year, and it'd be easy, like, I think it's easy for us now in 2023 too, to be like, oh, this is as bad as it's ever been. Things just keep getting worse, and we're on this, everything's on the skids. And I'm not saying there's not a lot of darkness, but I think it's interesting as a historical writer to kind of do what I did. And again, I didn't set out to do this. It just sort of came out like, oh yeah, like the 30s were bad and the 60s were bad and now is bad. But like, I'm not trying to, like, my point is everything's always bad. I'm not saying that, but I, you know, there's always bad stuff, but there's always also in the bad stuff opportunities to not accept it and to use your powers, however big or however limited, to say like, no, I reject that. And I don't want to live with acceptance of that. And so what can I do to try to enchant a disenchanting world?
And I love the idea that she was able to make money and succeed in a way that she would never have imagined in the 1920s, just before the Great Depression. But the idea that she began to build and envision this castle one room at a time until it became a one-ton item. I mean, this is, I'm trying to imagine this. One ton, it cost her $500,000 to build, and she built it on a scale of 1 inch to 1 foot.
Yeah.
I mean, that's huge when you think about this.
Yeah.
But then to also take it on the road and go, I'm going to take this on a national tour and see if I can raise money to help children in need. I think that was just so admirable as a central idea that travels through the novel and then brings it to 1968. And then you're reminded about that all over again, because we've got a whole bunch of decades happening between that and 1968.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the things too that I thought was interesting was like how at the time, like celebrity charity stuff wasn't like what it is today. Like people didn't do the stuff, you know, as they commonly do now, for either sincere reasons or for tax breaks or for, you know, like getting attention on something more wholesome than something perhaps more scandalous. And I think, you know, I tried to show in the book too, how two other women stars, Mary Pickford and Marion Davies. I don't know if there's any Pickford or Davies fans in the house, kind of also did this in an early way and sort of like set some precedents and some examples. And I think also it was a fun chance to show not just more dimensionality of like, hopefully, you know, sending people back to Colleen Moore, but also to people like Lillian Gish and people like Marion Davies. And if you've seen Citizen Kane, you know, there's like the character that's like based off her and just makes her into this like sad cartoon. And if you really go and look at Marion Davies, who was William Randolph Hearst's mistress, and who was in a lot of pictures that were, you know, produced by him and stuff like that, like in her finest work, she's so good. Like her comic timing is amazing. I mean, she's, if you watch her in like Show People or The Patsy, she's just so good. And so I hope people go see that. Or Lillian Gish also, I think she's just, you know, in a movie like The Wind. And I think, you know, one of the things I get into in those decades that keep going by is like the talking pictures were a displacement. And I think what's interesting is that Colleen / Doreen passed the sound test and could have kept on in the field and did, you know, so she could have, but a lot of them didn't for lots of reasons. Like it wasn't as much fun as it used to be. The technology changed, but also the studio heads and the producers used it as a chance to kind of claw back some of the power that women had accrued. I mean, they did a lot of them dirty. They really messed with Lillian Gish's contract. Louise Brooks, same deal. So I just think, I don't know. I hope the book covers a lot of stuff and like uncovers stuff that, if you know, you'll see it more. And if you didn't know, now you'll know.
Can you talk, as a publisher of hybrid work, you're pretty well known, Rose Metal Press publishes hybrid work, and it's pretty well known for that. Can you tell us about your application of hybridness in your novel and how you thought of it and how you applied it to the novel?
Yeah, one of my friends, mostly an internet friend, but increasingly a friend, Heidi Zierowitz, who lives in the Twin Cities and is a professor and a writer, and she's going to co-edit the Rose Metal Press Field Guide to the Lyric Essay, so stay tuned. But she said that, like, she would describe my work as sort of a combination of historical fiction and docu-poetics, which sounds very, like, academic, but I like it, where she was sort of saying like, it is kind of, you know, what you'd expect from historical fiction, where like it's real characters, you know, kind of imagined and, you know, with dialogue and scenes and details that, you know, you weren't there for, you couldn't know, but also like an urge to like lyrically document things and not just literally document them like in an archive or for a museum or the Library of Congress, but to document them in sort of that aesthetic way. And so, I don't know, I kind of liked that. And I think, I write all the genres, poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, but I think those categories are more fluid or can be more fluid. And I think some of the most interesting work that people are doing is in those ways. So like, for example, we just put out the Rose Metal Press Field Guide to Graphic Literature. I don't know if people...
That was just last month.
Yeah, yeah. It's like comics, but so much more. So anything with like a image and text combination. So yeah, and I think even though I'm not, there's no pictures in this, I almost feel like there are. I name so many films and stuff so that I hope to an extent that when people read this, they'll read it with like their Google browser open and constantly be Googling and find all the glamour shots of these actresses, or be like, what did this guy really look like? Or go watch the film, because so many of them are lost, but so many of them that are around are in public domain, so you can watch clips of them at least. And I mean, I think that's the thing I want to say too. I think my urge to document stuff like this is to keep them from being lost forever, because in like 2013, the Library of Congress and Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation did a study to, you know, see like how many silent movies did we actually lose, because there is this qualitative feeling of like, oh, we know so much from this era is gone forever. And that's true, but they were like, but how much? And they said that something like 75% of all silent films, like all the films made between 1894 and 1930, are gone forever, like with not a trace, with not a reel, with nothing. And it's just, I don't know, that's so sad. So I feel like stuff like this can keep them from being lost, maybe.
I really like how you encapsulated the film industry in such a broad way, but also such a deep way. It made me think of the two films that she made, Flaming Youth and Sky Pilot. And I remember when I finished, when I put the novel down, I really had to sort of stop and think about, because I was born and raised in India, and for me, this entire period of the 1920s was so foreign to me, and I felt that you brought me to that time. You took me there, and I really understood what was going on back there, and I really enjoyed it very much. Can you talk about dialogue really quickly? And I think we'll jump to taking questions from the audience.
Yeah, dialogue. Yes, what's so interesting, I tried to do a lot, and we talked about this beforehand. I love writing dialogue, which is funny when you're writing a silent movie novel, because there's no dialogue in the movies. But they had title cards, which are so crucial. But yeah, I think I had a lot of fun. Even though obviously like the films themselves didn't, you know, they would sometimes have little quoted bits of dialogue that would flash on the title cards, but it wasn't, you know, the banter that we have now. But to be like, okay, but what would the real people be saying? Like, what would they say at the parties? Like, what kind of gossip, what kind of warnings or suggestions would they be giving to each other? And then also sort of domestically, like how would people talk privately, like how would Doreen talk to her husband versus how she would talk to Marion when she was out at a party, or how would the producers talk to a young female star? And then also, how would Gladys, as this, you know, recorder, prompt her subject to kind of like stay on topic but also go off topic? I think, you know, again, because so many students are here, a thing I always tell people and tell myself, because it's hard on the first draft, is like, don't recapitulate in dialogue what you've already done in narration, and vice versa. The dialogue should do something new, and you can really do like a ton with dialogue and like scoot stuff along by just having people just like say stuff.
One of the big things I learned about dialogue was how it's important to use the dialogue to create unstable characters or do something in the dialogue to make something move the narrative forward. Thank you so much. I think that was pretty awesome. I'm so psyched about this and your success, and congratulations. It's a big moment for you.
And I want to say, before we take questions from the audience, I just want to say like a million billion thank yous to Ignatius. If you don't know Ignatius's work, you should check out the novel Fish Head, and you should also check out the Sunday Salon reading series. It happens here in Chicago. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Really quickly, I've been hosting Sunday Salon Chicago, and it's sundaysalon-chicago.com, and we invite authors from all over the country to come and read every month. We do it Zoom and in person at Roscoe Books. So check it out. Good to see you. So I think we're going to take questions from the audience.
Yeah.
So the mic is back here. If you have a question, come on back and we'll line you up. There's also, for those of you on Zoom, you can put your question in the chat and we will read it out to Kathleen at some point through this process.
Awesome.
So I'm going to hand it over to our first question.
Thank you. Hi. The question I wanted to ask you was about, in both Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk and From Dust to Stardust, you write in the first person. And I wonder how different it would be if you wrote in the third person. How does it change the nature of the book and the story by changing the person in which you write?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. And like I did in Cher Ami and Major Whittlesey, I also did first person from the perspective of a World War One soldier, and first person perspective of a pigeon, which some people loved and some people thought was silly, but, you know, don't cater to the haters. I like the intimacy of first person. And so when I'm teaching it and when I'm thinking about it, I think of it almost mathematically, like an axis, you know, a set of axes, where, you know, one is intimacy and one is information. And oftentimes they are in an inverse relationship. Like the more intimacy you get, the harder it can be to get that galaxy brain of information. Or the more, you know, if you're like a third person narrator, like an omniscient, you know, godlike narrator who knows everything, that can be so satisfying, but it's not the intimacy. You feel the cosmic distance. So I like all of them, but I think so far, one of the things that I don't know, I don't want to get too weird, but I'll just get a little weird. It's like doing almost like a seance. It's almost like becoming like sniffing the vapors at Delphi and speaking. You're just like, what is this person? And I mean, that might sound weird, but it's really like haunting yourself to haunt other people with the spirit of the dead, and the dead that you don't want to be dead, and the dead that you don't want to be dead forever. Because I don't know, I think as a culture, we're like kind of biased against the dead. We're always on to the new and the next, and I like to go back to them and like respect the dead. You can do that in third person, but I think, you know, I like that intimacy of truly trying to use the power of fiction to like get into the shoes of someone who's not you, but who you want to understand better. But that being said, I am in the process. I don't know. I like, this could all just go off the rails, but I'm writing a third person thing now about a historical figure. So I don't know. Will my agent like it? Will anyone buy it? That's always the question. But I love the possibilities of all points of view. So we'll see. Great question. Thank you. Thank you, Nancy.
Hi. I'm only familiar with your last three books, but all of them are historical, or at least based on a historical character, either a person or a pigeon. And I'm interested in your creative process, how you pick the historical figures, whether you know enough about their history that you see an arc of a plot, or you're just interested enough in the person that you inhabit them and the plot develops as you're writing. So could you talk about that? And I'm also interested that you know, you're not doing strictly historical fiction. You've changed the name of the character. So to create a little distance. So if you would talk about that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, great set of questions. I think, you know, I don't know, it's going to be like cheesy to do like the chiasmus, like, you know, do I find the historical figures or do they find me? But like, kind of, do they? I think they kind of do. Like, I think, I mean, I'm someone who is drawn to the past and drawn to what came before us and ways of life that are no longer practiced, but that are still like fascinating. So like in the case of Lillian, my best friend from high school, Angela, who also introduced me to my spouse, Martin, she's one of those friends. I just found her in the archive. She was an archivist and got to process the papers when, you know, the real life woman, Margaret Fishback, when her son donated her stuff. And so then, you know, she was like, you're going to love this person. And I did. And so that, you know, became Lillian Boxfish. And then with the Cheremy and Major Whittlesey, it was a student at DePaul, Brian Michich, who was like, he's the one who brought, you know, through all these different circumstances, Cheremy into my life. And I think I just like went literally to the Wikipedia page and was like, how is there not already a novel about these two people? And then same thing, with Colleen Moore. I mean, I recommend, and it's, I have an author's note at the end. I recommend Silent Star, her autobiography, and then Jeff Kadori, who's a biographer, wrote a biography, and it's also a great filmography, of her. You know, but I couldn't believe that there wasn't someone else hadn't gotten to it first. And then I think the current thing that I'm working on is a student, another former student, Jesse Keery, who may or may not be on Zoom, but hi, Jesse, if you're listening, sent me a postcard of Martha Maxwell, this scientist from, you know, the mid-1800s. I won't go too far into the weeds, but it's just like, I think too, now I have like a reputation. So people like Jesse are like, you know what to do with this, you know, like this lady's like in your wheelhouse. So send me things if you have something, I don't know, I'll be like one of those like kiosks, like your name on a grain of rice, like your historical figure novelized. But then the name stuff, I think, you know, it's with, I always said, you know, with Lillian and with Cheremy and with, you know, this, like without the original characters, there'd be no, fiction. And in the case of, Cheremy and Whittlesey, I stuck really, really closely to that story because it is so on the record and it's military history and it's in the Smithsonian and it's so, you know, films and stuff have been made about it. But with Lillian and Colleen, I felt like I did want to change things. Like for, you know, to clear the record, in real life, by all accounts, the real Colleen Moore's family was super supportive. It wasn't just her grandma. It was like a very supportive environment. But I wanted to explore kind of like the sea change that happened with flappers and the radical departure of the way women started behaving in the late teens and 20s versus like the Victorian mores that came before. So it behooved me to change that. And I think changing names lets you get a little more free to make a story that's more to your purpose. So I think, you know, I don't know. And also to make a story that's like this weighs in at under like 300 pages. And I think if I, you know, didn't give myself that freedom, I would have tried to put every single real detail in, and that would be not a good novel. It would be something, but not a good novel. So hopefully that answers your question.
Hi. So first, thank you so much for the wonderful, thought-provoking conversation, especially concepts of divinity are things I'm always interested in. But something else that I've been reflecting on lately that I'm hearing a lot from this conversation is sort of the concept of fame and this idea of people kind of at a higher level in terms of being known. And from this book, what would you say you have learned about what draws people to fame, whether that be as a famous person or like adoring famous people as someone who's on the outside?
Yeah. Great question. I love that. I think this book is very much about magic, and I think fame is like a magic power in a way, in a very thin place kind of way. Like I was saying about like the fairies and the Celtic concept, they're people who can give you much, but they're also people who can take much. And that to me is what fame seems like. Like if you're famous, you get a lot, but also a lot is taken of you. You lose the ability to just like walk down the street and not be like accosted for like all your time and attention. And I know I don't, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, they must have wanted it. And like, who feels sorry for famous people? But I think a lot of times people get it and don't realize that they've gotten it or at what cost they've gotten it, or how one of the things I explore here and one of the things I think that's so admirable about the real inspiration Colleen and try to show with Dorian is like, the fact that she achieved this fame in one field and then when it was over, found other stuff to do and lived this beautiful, fulfilling life and didn't let it destroy her that she wasn't going to be able to do exactly what she did before. And if you look at, you know, Hollywood now, but certainly Hollywood then, it didn't work for so many people. There's so many tragic stories of people who were kind of either like used by the industry or made their own, you know, bad decisions. The one that I put in the book that just haunts me is Alma Rubens, who was an amazing actress, but she became addicted to heroin and she lost her memory. Like, so she passed her sound test, but she couldn't remember lines. And if you can't do that in a talking picture, you can't work. And so she just kind of got, her fame ended in a very tragic way and she died young and no one really cared. So I think, you know, it's like, it's magic, but it's also like dark magic sometimes.
I think we are done with questions, and I just want to say I hope that once again this is a bestseller and you are famous from it. So, but thank you to Kathleen. Thank you, Ignatius.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.